Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 65, a double special edition of Racism and the Dual Epidemics of COVID-19 and Police Violence. It's Friday, June 5th. I'm coming to you from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Today, I am devoting this show to racism and how racism drives both the COVID-19 epidemic and the epidemic of police violence in America today. Racism is a public health crisis. Racism is the underlying cause of a myriad of health disparities in America today. Without recognizing and directly addressing racism, these health disparities can never be fully or even adequately addressed. Well, let's get started. First up, from the OhioHouse.gov, Ohio Legislative Black Caucus declares racism a public health crisis. The Ohio Legislative Black Caucus today announced plans to introduce legislation that would declare racism a public health crisis, echoing similar calls in Cleveland and Franklin County recently. The resolution, if passed, would be the first of its kind passed at the state level anywhere. Our citizens of color have been subjected to the effects of racism since the founding of the state of Ohio in 1803. Since that time, Ohioans of color have endured unequal education, unsafe work conditions, inadequate health care services, subpar housing, and an unjust criminal justice system, based on policies that were rooted in a belief that people of color are not worthy of the American dream. By declaring racism a public health crisis, we acknowledge that racism impacts all members of our society and deserve action from all levels of government. The resolution comes on the heels of Thursday night's protests in Columbus in advance of more protests planned around the state over the weekend following the death of George Floyd. Protests over his death have erupted throughout the country. Black America woke this morning to a nightmare that seems to never end and a continued feeling of hopelessness that nothing will ever be better. Ohio Legislative Black Caucus President Representative Stephanie House, Democrat from Cleveland, said, "What we are witnessing around the country is a community simply begging to be seen and heard. Racism is real, and it is the biggest public health threat citizens of color face." By being the first state to adopt this resolution, we hope Ohio can be a model for the nation, showing the rest of the country how we can lead these difficult discussions and enact real and meaningful change. Black Ohioans deserve to be heard today, tomorrow, and always. I know where the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus stands when it comes to addressing the hurt people across this country and in the state of Ohio. The real question is, where does Governor DeWine, Lieutenant Governor Husted, President Obhof, Speaker Householder, members of the Ohio General Assembly, and other white people in positions of power stand? When will they be forced to atone for the sins of this country and the state of Ohio against black and brown people? I hope to see all my colleagues on both sides of the aisle join us as co-sponsors for this resolution. At a time when COVID-19 is disproportionately hospitalizing and killing the black community because of racism, the time to act is now. The resolution calls for the following actions: establishing a glossary of terms and definitions concerning racism and health equity. Assert that racism is a public health crisis affecting our entire community. Incorporating educational efforts to address and dismantle racism and expand understanding of racism and how racism affects individual and population health. promoting community engagement, actively engaging citizens on issues of racism, providing tools to engage actively and authentically with communities of color, committing to review all portions of codified ordinances with a racial equity lens, committing to conduct all human resources, vendor selection, and grant management activities with a racial equity lens, including reviewing all internal policies and practices such as hiring, promotions, leadership appointments, and funding. Promoting racially equitable economic and workforce development practices. Promoting and encouraging all policies that prioritize the health of people of color and support local, state, regional, and federal initiatives that advance efforts to dismantle systematic racism and mitigating exposure to adverse childhood experience and trauma. Training of all elected officials, staff, funders, and grantees on workplace biases and how to mitigate them. Partnering and building alliances with local organizations that have a legacy and track record of confronting racism. Encouraging community partners and stakeholders in the education, employment, housing, and criminal justice and safety arenas to recognize racism as a public health crisis and to activate the above items. Securing adequate resources to successfully accomplish the above activities. And in another bit of good news, our own Toledo City Council passed a resolution on Tuesday supporting this state legislation. The Ohio Public Health Association has also issued a declaration of racism as a public health crisis. And here I'd like to read this statement from Physicians for a National Health Program. The horrific murder of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police has sparked nationwide protests. Physicians for a National Health Program, an organization of more than 23,000 doctors who support Medicare for All, denounces police brutality and racism in all forms, demands immediate steps to ensure racial justice at all levels of government, and calls for racism and racial health inequality to be treated as public health emergencies. The murder of Floyd, said Dr. Adam Gaffney, president of Physicians for a National Health Program, is yet the latest example of the pervasive racism that sickens our nation. It is emblematic of the deeply entrenched system of institutionalized racism that afflicts both our criminal justice and healthcare systems. Police violence is a public health emergency. Police violence is a leading cause of death for young men of color. Black men in particular face a 1 in 1,000 chance of being killed by police and are 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than are white men. Over-policing in communities of color and sentencing disparities mean that in the U.S., which has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, Black Americans are incarcerated at a rate that is 5.1 times that of whites. Mass incarceration imposes a particular threat to health during the COVID-19 pandemic, given crowding and poor access to health care in these facilities. Physicians for a National Health Program has previously joined other groups in calling for immediate actions to safeguard the health of prisoners during the COVID-19 pandemic, including early release. Racism is a public health emergency. The current COVID-19 pandemic has laid bare the deep inequalities in our health system, as Black Americans are more than twice as likely, and in some states, 7 times as likely, to die from the virus than whites. Racial inequalities have, for too long, been tolerated and accepted as normal in this country, stated Dr. Susan Rogers, president-elect of Physicians for a National Health Program. The overt brutality displayed by police makes this clear, but these inequities extend to health care, housing, and education. Compared to whites, people of color are more likely to be uninsured, face barriers to care, and suffer and die from preventable health conditions like diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. Black families are also 3 times more likely to live in poverty compared to white families, and twice as likely to be food insecure, factors known to contribute to poor health. Physicians for a National Health Program is committed to fighting all forms of racial inequity, including the structural racism that puts Black people at substantially higher risk of police violence and incarceration, and a broken healthcare system that denies patients of color the right to health and health care. Okay, and more action by health professionals from CNN. Over 1,000 health professionals signed a letter saying, "Don't shut down protests using coronavirus concerns as an excuse." A group of health and medical colleagues have penned an open letter to express their concern that protests around the United States could be shut down under the guise of coronavirus health concerns. "We created the letter in response to emerging narratives that seem to malign demonstrations as risky for the public health because of COVID-19, according to the letter writers, many of whom are part of the University of Washington's Division of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Instead, we want to present a narrative that prioritizes opposition to racism as vital to the public health, including the epidemic response. We believe that the way forward is not to suppress protests in the name of public health, but to respond to protesters' demands in the name of public health, thereby addressing multiple public health crises. The letter focuses on health guidance for protesters and law enforcement, such as wearing masks, advocating to not hold people who are arrested in close proximity, and opposing the use of tear gas for health reasons. The letter writers said they are concerned about health implications of protests, including how tear gas or smoke might cause people to cough, which can spread the coronavirus, and that people may be spending a lot of time together and not able to stay 6 feet apart. Okay, this from Associated Press. Protests in top 25 virus hotspots ignite fears of contagions. As demonstrators flooded streets across America to decry the killing of George Floyd, public health experts watched in alarm. The close proximity of protesters and their failures in many cases to wear masks, along with the police using tear gas, could fuel new transmissions of the coronavirus. Many of the protests broke out in places where the virus is still circulating widely in the population. In fact, an Associated Press review found that demonstrations have taken place in every one of the 25 U.S. communities with the highest concentrations of new cases. Some have seen major protests over multiple days, including Minneapolis-St. Paul, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles. The protests have come just as communities across the nation loosen restrictions on businesses and public life that have helped slow the spread of the virus, deepening concern that the two factors taken together could create a national resurgence in cases. The Associated Press's review focused on large metro counties, the central counties within metro areas with more than 1 million people, that showed the highest rates of new cases per capita over the past 14 days. While case numbers and deaths have been trending down in several of the cities where the largest protests have occurred, the number of people in those places infected with the virus and with the ability to spread it remains high. And in some of the communities, such as Minneapolis, the number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 has been rising. The unrest has coincided with the very worst days of the pandemic so far in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, said Michael Osterholm, the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Our ICU bed care is at its all-time high and is really on the edge, he said. Ramsey and Hennepin counties, home to the Twin Cities, ranked 7th and 8th for the highest per capita new cases in the Associated Press analysis. Each has seen more than 250 cases per 100,000 population in the past 2 weeks, together reporting nearly 2,000 new cases in the last week alone. Experts point out that other factors associated with protests could accelerate the spread of the virus. For instance, tear gas can cause people to cough and sneeze, as can the smoke from fires set by people bent on destruction. And both also prompt protesters to remove their masks. Crowding protesters who have been arrested into jail cells can also increase the risk of contagion. An Associated Press tally found that, thus far, more than 5,600 people have been taken into custody. Protesters and police shouting at one another nose-to-nose also raises alarms. Osterholm and other public health experts note, however, that the protests aren't necessarily as alarming as other events that could fuel new cases because they take place outside and many people are wearing masks. In some cases, hand sanitizer also is being informally distributed. And Dr. David Eisenman, director of the Center for Public Health and Disasters at UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, said he feared partisan forces might accuse cities of bringing fresh cases on themselves. I'm actually more worried about how, if these spikes occur, how that information will be weaponized against the notion of protests, he said. Eisenman called protesting an essential activity, possible to practice with reduced risk. He said his grown children protested in Los Angeles and are taking safety precautions now, including isolating themselves at home. They plan to get tested for COVID-19 in about a week. Public health experts said it will take 2 to 3 weeks to know whether the protests cause a surge in coronavirus cases, and even then, they can't definitively tie it to the demonstrations. The unrest is happening in tandem with the reopening of gyms, hair salons, restaurants, parks, and beaches. It also comes on the heels of the Memorial Day weekend, when many people attended large gatherings, so experts already were bracing for a case increase, said Jennifer Nuzzo, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University. In Los Angeles, barbershops and in-person dining were allowed to resume last weekend, just as protests descended into destruction and more than 1,000 people were arrested. Nearly 10,000 new cases have been reported in Los Angeles County in the past week. Hundreds of people also were arrested in Chicago, where Cook County has among the highest per capita rates of new cases of any large county in the nation, with 283 new cases per 100,000 population in the past 2 weeks. The absolute numbers of cases is still high. We feel good about the fact that we've established a decreasing incidence, but we have a ways to go, said Dr. Ronald Hershaw, the director of the Division of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of Illinois Chicago. Hershaw and others noted that the racial disparities laid bare by coronavirus, with communities of color bearing a disproportionate burden of infections and deaths, overlap with the issues being protested on streets across America and around the globe. Racism killed, Hershaw said. Sometimes that's direct, as in the case of George Floyd, and sometimes it's through a virus, like COVID-19. Okay, from the New York Times. Protests draw shoulder-to-shoulder crowds after months of virus isolation. For days, Kate Dixon has been watching the videos of demonstrators from her home in a Denver suburb. The images of young people packed shoulder-to-shoulder, crowds shouting in unison on downtown streets. The occasional detente between protesters and police officer that ends in a hug. You want that to be a wonderful moment, said Ms. Dixon, a stay-at-home mother who has been sewing face masks in her spare time. But your heart just hurts at the illness that this could be causing. In the last week, the United States has abruptly shifted from one crippling crisis to the next. Most Americans have been under stay-at-home orders for months to slow the coronavirus pandemic. Restrictions that were gradually eased throughout May, freeing people in many states to begin venturing back into shops and restaurants. Then came Memorial Day in Minneapolis, when George Floyd, a black man, died after pleading that he could not breathe as a white police officer pressed his knee into Mr. Floyd's neck. His death has prompted cascading protests in hundreds of cities where demonstrators have called for an end to police brutality and racist institutions. Suddenly, America no longer looks like a nation cooped up at home. The demonstrations have spurred fears that they could cause a deadly resurgence of the coronavirus, and for those sympathetic to a growing movement, deciding whether to attend protests has been complicated. Some people have avoided them entirely, reasoning that the chance of contracting the coronavirus in a crowd is too high. Others have joined despite the risks. The police violence against black people, that's a pandemic too, said Kelly Ann Thomas, community organizer who joined protests in Miami. People are willing to risk their lives, to risk their health, to show solidarity with black people. No one has studied the precise dynamics of how the virus may be transmitted under the mix of conditions that prevail at mass protests. And because of delays between exposure of the virus and the start of symptoms, and then hospitalizations and deaths, the impact of the protests on virus spread will not be known for several weeks. Health experts know that the virus is far less likely to be spread outdoors than indoors, and masks reduce the chance of infected people transmitting the respiratory droplets that contain the virus. But many uncertainties remain. Yelling, shouting, and singing can increase how far those droplets are projected. Crowds and the length of time in an uninfected person is near someone who is infected also increase the risk of transmission. Protests have revealed a range of precautions, from people wearing tightly secured masks to others with no face covering. On Monday, a nurse's assistant who works at a nursing home was among the protesters at the site where Mr. Floyd died in Minneapolis, showing up in a mask and scrubs. Contagion was weighing on the mind of Jamie Schwensdell in the first days of protest. He owns Moon Palace Books down the street from the police station that was set on fire last weekend after demonstrators clashed with the police. Black people were already suffering from a disproportionate number of coronavirus infections. Now, many members of their community are protesting the death of Mr. Floyd. The idea of getting a whole lot of people together to yell, which we know is one of the most effective ways to transmit the virus, and having that happen around a lot of people of color and neighborhoods and communities of color is very stressful, said Mr. Schwensdell, who is white. It just adds this whole stress of how this is going to impact the infection rates. In Denver, Tay Anderson, a protest leader and school board member, has been worried about the disparate impact of the coronavirus on black Colorado residents like himself. Thousands of people marched through Denver and laid down, shoulder to shoulder, on the lawn of the Capitol in silent demonstrations. He put out a call on social media for all protesters to join him in getting tested for the coronavirus on Saturday morning at the Pepsi Center, a sports and concert arena where Denver has been running free, large-scale testing. We are still in a pandemic, he wrote on Twitter. In Los Angeles, city leaders have expressed alarm that the protests could fuel the spread of the coronavirus, while at the same time voicing support for the rights of demonstrators to gather and saying that they shared in the outrage over the death of Mr. Floyd. Mayor Eric Garcetti warned that the gatherings could become super spreader events, not unlike during the 1918 flu pandemic, when after the first wave infection, some cities began holding parades and large gatherings that led to a second, more deadly wave. Some of the city's virus testing sites have had to be shut down briefly, and while jail populations have been reduced over concerns about the spread of the virus in tightly controlled institutions, they now are filling again after mass arrests. Though the pandemic has slowed somewhat in recent weeks, the virus continues to infect thousands and kill hundreds every day. Many of the country's big cities have been adding several hundred new cases every day. On Monday, nearly 1,000 new cases were identified in Los Angeles County, California, more than 500 in Cook County, Illinois, and more than 400 in New York City. In the county that includes Minneapolis, more than 1,000 new cases have been identified over the past week, and officials have urged protesters to seek coronavirus testing. Epidemiologists said the protests would almost certainly lead to more cases of the virus. Large gatherings of people are known to have led to chains of transmission in other settings, and police tactics such as spraying tear gas, which causes people to cough, herding protesters into smaller areas for crowd control, and placing arrested individuals in buses, vans, and holding cells also increase the risk of infection. An aggregate model assembled by researchers at the University of Massachusetts projects that the nation will see between 5,000 to 7,000 deaths from COVID-19 each week over the next month. But public health experts emphasize the police violence against black people in America also represents a public health crisis. The anger over economic, social, and health disparities fueling the protests, health experts said, are reflected in sharply higher rates of coronavirus-related deaths and illness among black Americans. Several counsel a harm reduction approach that would allow people to join the demonstration as safely as possible. Last week, all news was about COVID. This week, all the news is about the protests, said Eleanor Murray, an assistant professor of epidemiology at Boston University School of Public Health. But really, these are two pieces of the same conversation. Yolanda Williams, the host of the podcast Parenting Decolonized, which focuses on parenting black children, said she has not attended protests in Little Rock, Arkansas, where she lives. She's a single mother of a toddler, and her area has seen a spike in COVID-19 cases. But she had a message on her Facebook page for those among her followers who are white: you should be showing up. I know it's scary, but if you're committed to dismantling white supremacy, it's you that needs to be out there en masse, protesting as loud for civil rights as you did for the Women's March, she said in the post. In an interview, Ms. Williams said she was trying to drive home the point that it is far riskier for black people to attend protests than it is for white people. The problem is we are having to choose from either dying from COVID or dying from cops, she said. Put yourself in the line like we are doing every day. Put your body on the line. For many public health experts who have spent weeks advising policymakers and the public on how to reduce their risk of getting or inadvertently spreading the coronavirus, the mass demonstrations have forced a shift in perspective. Tiffany Rodriguez, an epidemiologist who has rarely left her home since mid-March, said it was often impossible to maintain the recommended 6 feet of distance at the protest she attended in Boston. But understanding that police brutality is a public health epidemic, she said she felt compelled to go. Next up from Stat News, racism, the contagion in healthcare we need to eradicate. The virus persists in the bloodstream for years, often spanning generations. The warning signs aren't always obvious and don't follow the traditional path for how an infection progresses in humans. Even so, it exerts its sinister effects on the individuals infected and everyone around them. Some with a community-acquired form of this illness demonstrate moderate to severe symptoms, a profound sense of entitlement, panicked calls to 911 using histrionic language, irrational acting out in murderous rage, hunting down and executing joggers, breaking, entering, and murdering without identifying yourself, applying pressure with the knee on the back to the point of asphyxiation, disguised as, quote, protect and serve. The justified outrage among medical communities in reaction to this acute outbreak has been swift. Healthcare workers joining communities in unity and protests, calls for social justice from medical and public health officials on social media, official statements denouncing the structural nature of this pandemic from national and international medical organizations. But if you look closely, medical systems and personnel have been struggling with the same disease for decades, albeit with different clinical manifestations. Withholding appropriate pain medication from patients who needed it, avoiding medically necessary curative interventions, discharging patients to their homes instead of testing and admitting them to a hospital, bias when prescribing biomedical HIV prevention options, selectively choosing social apathy over established clinical guidelines. Some healthcare workers who demonstrate milder subclinical findings are often mistaken as asymptomatic. These comprise the majority of cases. Symptoms may include lecturing patients about not doing the very same things they do in their personal lives, perpetuating inequities in academic promotional advancement, diagnosing subjects with anxiety or depression before initiating a proper medical workup, vocal disregard for human life, choosing silence when a colleague exhibits severe manifestations of the affliction toward a coworker or patient. People of no color are disproportionately affected but suffer none of the resulting health inequities. As a black man in a white coat, I represent about 5% of currently active physicians. I've encountered enough people afflicted with this disorder that I deserve a special board certification in the field. They have mistaken me for a parking attendant or a hotel van driver when I was wearing a suit for my medical residency interviews. They advise me not to apply to the top-rated residency programs and instead focus on local, quote, community programs. Some even question my training, experience, and expertise, suggesting I wasn't really a doctor. I've experienced this both as a member of the community and as a member of the medical establishment. I am not an isolated case. The expression of this ailment varies but represents different points along the same clinical continuum. Testing and contact tracing for this contagion are limited, as many don't perceive themselves to be at risk. Exposure to and demonstration against the disease doesn't guarantee immunity and certainly doesn't produce antibodies. Various treatments have been proposed, but none of them curative, and there is no vaccine. The only current accepted management involves rigorous self-reflection and introspection, but most are reluctant to adopt this inconvenient intervention. Many healthcare workers suffering from this infection don't think they have it because their symptoms don't reflect the more severe cases highlighted in media reports, but they do, and they represent walking statistics in a centuries-old pandemic, transmitting the virus to susceptible colleagues, students, trainees, and vulnerable patients at every turn. The only difference is that the deaths stemming from their version of the illness are enacted in a slower, quieter, and less public fashion than a knee to the airway, but they are no less deadly or devastating. And also from Stat News, my nightmare, COVID-19 meets racism meets the killing of a black person by police. This is my nightmare, COVID-19 meets racism meets the killing of yet another black person by a police officer. Some weeks back in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, I had a discussion about worst-case scenarios with a colleague in emergency management. Top of mind for him as we head into hurricane season was the fear of a natural disaster in the midst of this pandemic. My biggest fear as a black woman and public health leader was the all-too-likely murder of an unarmed black person at the hands of police, leading to mass protests amid the virulence of two infectious diseases, racism and COVID-19. And here we are, a few weeks later, in the nightmarish scenario I can't unsee. Black American and allies, rightfully angry and fed up with the 400-plus years of racist violence and white supremacy, take to the streets to protest in cities around the country and the world. As we watched the gruesome suffocation and murder of George Floyd, we did so in self-isolation, left to scream and cry in horror alone during a pandemic that's disproportionately snatching the lives and economic footing of black people. It comes on the painful heels of the murders of Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Sandra Bland, Walter Scott, Philando Castillo, Michael Brown Jr., Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, Sean Bell, and Emmett Till, to name just a few, along with the millions of black bodies lost to slavery, Jim Crow, preventable health inequities, and the school-to-prison pipeline. COVID-19 continues to unearth the racist and unjust cracks in our society. Black people make up the majority of low-wage workers who remain on the front lines in positions that don't permit them the privilege to work from home, leverage paid sick leave, or access personal protective equipment. Thanks to a history of redlining and race-based residential segregation, many of these low-wage workers are living in close, cramped housing that makes social distancing all but impossible. On top of this, a dearth of federal and state-level racial and ethnic data on COVID-19 cases and deaths continues to devalue the humanity of black people and leave us in the dark about the true impacts of this pandemic in our communities. all while resources have been inequitably allocated to favor communities with food security, insurance coverage, internet access, and reliable transportation. Let me be clear, it's racism and not race that's the culprit here. Some of the symptoms of COVID-19 are temporary loss of senses, hallucinations, and shortness of breath or difficulty breathing. The symptoms of racism are strikingly similar. Temporary loss of senses. See Amy Cooper, who distorted the voice of a calm, measured black man and birdwatcher in New York Central Park into one that was threatening her life, and see Carolyn Bryant Donharm, who did the same to Emmett Till. Hallucinations. See Darren Wilson, the killer of Michael Brown Jr. in Ferguson, Missouri, who described the unarmed 18-year-old as a, quote, demon and Hulk Hogan-like figure as a justification for shooting him. Difficulty breathing. See centuries of transcripts citing police officers stating shortness of breath or trouble breathing moments after the murder of a black person. Black America is very clear on the pathology, symptoms, diagnosis, manifestations, evolution, and antidote for the malignant disease of racism, yet it remains largely unrecognized, undiagnosed, untreated, and unbothered in white America. While a vaccine for COVID-19 is in development, no sweeping cure currently exists for racism. Protesting racism is necessary. Doing it during a pandemic, however, is my deepest public health nightmare. It's nearly impossible to stay 6 feet apart in a crowd, and there's an increased chance of person-to-person COVID transmission in a crowd that is already at heightened risk. There will never be a convenient time to dismantle racism. Protests of the civil rights movement came with the same risks of beatings, water hoses, and deadly force, not unlike what we're seeing today. But the stakes are even higher in the center of a deadly and insidious pandemic. Protester or not, all of us can take action to protect the safety and health of the black community and stand in solidarity in this pivotal moment. If you choose to protest publicly, wear masks and gloves, especially if the march or demonstration involves holding hands. Carry hand sanitizer and try your best to keep 6 feet of empty space between you and others, even while marching. When you get home, immediately wash your clothes and take a shower. State and local leaders should prioritize safety and equity for black communities in their COVID-19 response. They should reconsider the use of pepper spray, since the coughing it provokes increases the risk of transmitting COVID-19. Law enforcement officers should be trained in equity and de-escalation tactics. Non-black allies can stand with us in solidarity and unity. The white community in particular should leverage its position of privilege to make systematic anti-racist changes, starting with themselves, their families, and their networks. I'm tired, and I know you are too. Racism is exhausting. It was created to exhaust our bodies, our resources, and our talents, but we can't let it. In a system that was never created for us to survive, self-preservation is a form of resistance. COVID-19 shouldn't be ravaging the black community. George Floyd didn't have to die. His murderer should be in jail. Black people shouldn't have to justify their humanity every second of every day. Yet all of that is why we are where we are as a country today, full of unrest, anger, resentment, and hurt. The layers of pain and anguish are unspeakable, and the black community is the only one told to swallow the pain and move on. This time, we refuse to. And this from Discover Magazine. George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery deaths, the everyday health harms of racism. High-profile police shootings and deaths of black men in custody, or even while out jogging, brings cries of racism across the country. The May 25th death of George Floyd by a white police officer in Minneapolis and the shooting death of Ahmaud Arbery in Brunswick, Georgia on February 23rd by a white father and son have resulted in outrage and protests in cities across the U.S. But as a public health researcher who studies the effects of racism on the health of black men, I have found that the life and death effects of racism in the U.S. go far beyond police shootings. I've also found that while racism harms many groups of people, black men are paying the highest cost. As a result of racism and associated poverty and injustice, life expectancy at birth of black men is 71.9 years, far below white women at 81.2 years, black women at 78.5, and white men at 76.4. These are mainly because of black men's higher risk of dying from several types of cancer, stroke, HIV, and homicide. Despite overall declining numbers of homicide in the U.S., homicide remains the number one cause of death for black males aged 10 to 24. My research and that of many others strongly links these deaths and poor physical and mental health outcomes, in general, to racism. For black men in the U.S., racism is a daily experience that harms their health and leads to chronic disease and poor health. About 66% of blacks report high levels of day-to-day racial discrimination. One example is being turned down for a job, as opposed to being treated differently on the job. On average, each black youth faces one major discriminatory experience each year. Discrimination is a major risk factor for health problems across the board, as shown by reviews. There are also blocked opportunities for black men and other types of discrimination that are less frequent but very consequential, also called major discriminatory events. Combined, these discriminatory experiences make living harder and shorter for black men than for other race or gender groups. While discrimination is known to be a risk factor for premature death, heart disease, depression, and suicide, we know black men experience discrimination more than other groups, including black women. As an associate professor of family medicine at Charles Drew University of Medicine and Science, a historically black medical school, I study how racism affects racial and ethnic minority people, particularly black men. My studies have shown that discrimination and racism are root causes of depression, anxiety, substance use, and suicide, as well as poor physical health. Education does not save black men. In a recent study, I found that sense of mastery, which refers to people's ability to take control of their life, could reduce psychological distress for black women. For black men, however, high levels of mastery were not enough to reduce psychological distress. In another study, I compared black men and black women for the effect of their educational attainment on their depressive symptoms and psychological distress. I analyzed data of 3,570 black adults and found that education protects black men less than it protects black women from depressive symptoms and psychological distress. That means black men are at risk of depressive symptoms and psychological distress at all levels of educational attainment. That is, their success is not enough to reduce their depression and distress. All these studies have used nationally represented data. Thus, the results are generalizable to the U.S. people. They all show a pattern called diminished returns of economic and non-economic resources for black men. Although they are also seen for other race by gender groups, they are most pronounced for black men. As a result of these diminished returns, black men who have high levels of aspirations and motivation to get to the top of society still get sick, feel unhealthy, and die early. In other words, as long as the U.S. unfairly treats black men, their very same resource would fail to protect them. So they show systematically poor outcomes regardless of their status in society. Again, these are not limited to, but worst for, black men. Racism in healthcare. Even the U.S. healthcare system treats black men worse than black women. This includes receiving a lower quality of healthcare compared to whites and even black women. Such discrimination deteriorates their ability to manage their disease, so they develop worse outcomes and get sicker. One of my papers shows that white men have a specific role in this. My work shows that anti-black bias is highest in white men, is higher in white men than white women. This is very concerning because white men have the highest level of power in law, politics, police, and many other institutions in the U.S. These all mean that odds are not in favor of black men. Recent shootings of black men, either by police or others, also shows that black men are specifically targeted by white men, the group which also is in charge of law and order. These all are examples of how social structures and biases cause poor health among black men. Money doesn't improve health for black men. Several of my studies have documented high risk of depression in black men and boys of high socioeconomic status. These studies show higher instead of lower risk of depression as a result of socioeconomic mobility in the U.S. One explanation for this is they pay a very high price for their ticket to the top of the society. This journey also opens our eyes to the real inequalities that exist in the U.S. society. In another study among black boys, high income increased the risk of depression, suggesting that high-income black boys are more, not less depressed than low-income black boys. In yet another study of mine, 25 years follow-up of American adults showed that high education actually increases depressive symptoms of black men over time. I did not see this pattern in white men, white women, or even black women. In another study, I found that white men gain most life expectancy from their employment. The gain was smaller, but still considerable for white women and black women. Black men, however, died earlier, regardless of their employment. Thus, in today's U.S., racism is a root cause of poor health of black men, given the societal structure, personal assets, ambitions such as advanced education, income, employment do not insulate black men from the racism of the American society they live in. In fact, these assets increase the likelihood of black men to be discriminated. Many studies have shown that racism, discrimination, prejudice, and related environmental stressors have a more prominent role in causing anxiety, depression, substance use, and poor physical health of black men than black women. Questions we should ask ourselves as a society. I end this conversation with a few questions for my fellow Americans. How on earth can social mobility make the lives of white Americans easier, but not for black men? Why should social status increase rather than decrease black men's exposure and vulnerability to discrimination? Why, for whites, does discrimination vanish if people attain high levels of success, but for black men, discrimination increases as they move up the social ladder? Why does success increase discriminatory experiences of black men? Racism, however, is bad for everyone's health, not just black men. It is just bad in a different way. Everyone dies sooner in a racist community. This is partially because societal inequalities increase people's vulnerabilities, even the most privileged ones.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
And this from Stat News. Which death do they choose? Many black men fear wearing a mask more than the coronavirus. When the CDC issued guidelines in early March asking people to wear masks to prevent the spread of coronavirus, the question for many black men was not where to get a mask or which kind. It was, how do I cover my face and not get shot? As the recent killing of George Floyd made achingly clear, the widespread fear of violent death at the hands of law enforcement is not unfounded. Being killed by police is one of the leading causes of death for young black men. A study last year found 1 in 1,000 black men in America could expect to be killed by police. Despite their fears of infection, and statistics showing black communities are among the hardest hit, many black men feel wearing a mask is a bigger threat than the coronavirus, just as they are more likely than white people to be stopped and frisked, to be pulled over for traffic violations, and to be charged with drug crimes. Black individuals also appear more likely to be targeted by police for simply wearing masks. In a heartbreaking calculus, many are choosing not to wear them at all. Which death do you choose, COVID-19 or police shooting? Asked Vicky Mays, a distinguished professor of health policy and management at UCLA School of Public Health, who studies health disparities and has been tracking incidents where black men wearing masks were harassed. We have African Americans who have been dragged out of stores, who have been ordered by police and store guards to pull their masks down or take their masks off. You also see people protesting during this pandemic because people feel strongly what is happening to them is worse than the risk of death, said Mays, who is also a professor of psychology. These are horrible risk assessments no one should have to make. One black man who was recently targeted is Cam Buckner, a 35-year-old attorney and state senator from Illinois, who was shopping at his local hardware store in Chicago's South Loop while wearing a face mask, as mandated by an executive order in Illinois. While many white customers streamed by wearing masks, a uniformed officer stopped Buckner as he was leaving the store with a cart, asking to see his receipt and ID. "It wasn't like I had anything that was the least provocative in my cart. It was flowers from my garden," Buckner told Stat in a phone interview from his porch as protesters marched just yards away. "When I asked why," he said, "I can't see your face. You look like you might have been up to something." Trying not to escalate the situation, the 6'4" Buckner nodded and went home, but he grew increasingly upset. "It woke me up in the middle of the night, and I said, 'This is not okay,'" said Buckner. "I thought about all the millions of black men around the country being told they have to wear masks. We are extremely apprehensive about the mask, even though we know it's the right thing to do. Buckner was reluctant to start a battle with his police department and mayor, but he took to Twitter with his story. He said because the incident had left him heartsick. COVID will not break us, he tweeted. It will only reveal to us what is already broken. Similar incidents are occurring around the country. In Florida, a Black University of Miami physician, Armin Henderson, part of a team voluntary to help test homeless people for the coronavirus, was arrested while wearing a mask as he unloaded supplies from his van into his front yard. Two masked young Black men shopping in a Walmart in Wood River, Illinois, posted a video that went viral of a police officer, hand on his weapon, ushering them out of the store after telling them their masks were illegal. The police officer just put us out for wearing masks, trying to stay safe, they said as they left the store. Wood River Police Chief Brad Wells later admitted the officers had been wrong and said he supports the wearing of face masks. The first assumption wasn't that these people are protecting themselves and others around them from the virus. It was just the assumption of stealing or some ill will, said Mays. There's a quick judgment of what Black men are up to. Many in the Black community have taken to social media with their concerns about wearing masks in public. Used to toning down their appearances to lower suspicion, wearing college t-shirts when they run, and, quote, dressing like prospects, not suspects, many immediately considered mask choices that might be safer and allow them to return home from their grocery store trips or, mindful of the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, jog through the neighborhood alive. New mask is floral, don't shoot, tweeted Casey Lehman. Handmade white masks will, hopefully, wrap us in a cloud-like innocence, Drew Brees wrote in Medium. Mothers like Kim Homan tweeted their fear, is it safer for my son to risk COVID-19 than to risk being seen as a tall Black man in a mask? Aaron Thomas, a Black man from Ohio who chose not to wear a mask, may have put it best, writing, I want to stay alive, but I also want to stay alive. In some cases, Black people are also targeted for not wearing masks. A Black man in Philadelphia was pulled off a bus by 7 police officers for not wearing one. After a video of the incident went viral, the SEPTA Transit Authority admitted it had done a poor job notifying the public about the requirement and said masks were no longer required. Such incidents spurred 6 U.S. senators, including Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, to send a letter asking the Department of Justice and the FBI to provide bias training to law enforcement officers during the pandemic. May said leaders need to acknowledge that the targeting of Black men wearing masks clearly stems from racism, as do numerous other issues in the response to the pandemic, from the lack of systematic data collection on race of those infected by the coronavirus to the inability to quickly get personal protective equipment to essential workers of color. People were making masks and buying masks for healthcare workers, but they didn't give these things to the janitors cleaning up. They didn't give these things to the bus drivers, she said. Mays advises Black men to wear masks and suggests they not be dark colors or ominous looking, but perhaps made from bright colors or traditional African prints. She notes that professionally sewn masks can be expensive and says masks are another commodity like food, water, and virus testing that health officials are not quickly getting to minority communities that need them. Why isn't the city or county thinking about going into these communities and passing out masks for free, she asks. Despite his experience, Buckner said he's still going to wear a mask, in part to protect his father, who has risk factors making him more vulnerable to COVID-19. The issue around masks heightens the anxiety Buckner already feels about the coronavirus, the sadness he accepts about having been profiled his entire life, and the fear he feels as his young nephews negotiate the world, the pandemic, and local police. None of the issues the Black community is facing because of the virus, he said, can be separated from the police violence many Americans are now protesting, despite the risk of infection. There are some people, and I represent many of them, for whom COVID is not the scariest thing in their life, he said. We've got to listen to them. And this next story from ProPublica. Tear gas is way more dangerous than police let on, especially during the coronavirus pandemic. When Amira Chowdhury joined a protest in Philadelphia against police violence, she wore a mask to protect herself and others against the coronavirus. But when officers launched tear gas into the crowd, Chowdhury pulled off her mask as she gasped for air. I couldn't breathe, she said. I felt like I was choking to death. Chowdhury was on part of the Vine Street expressway that ran underground. Everyone panicked as gas drifted into the dark, semi-enclosed space, she said. People stomped over her as they scrambled away. Bruised, she scaled a fence to escape. But the tear gas found her later that evening, inside her own house, as police unleashed it on protesters in a predominantly Black neighborhood in West Philadelphia. It seeped in. I can't even be in my own house without escaping the violence of the state, said Chowdhury, a rising senior at the University of Pennsylvania. She said her throat still felt dry, like it was clogged with ash. The Philadelphia protest was one of many instances in recent days in which police launched tear gas, a toxic substance that can cause lung damage, into crowds. In a statement, Police Commissioner Danielle Outlaw said that officers had no choice but to release it after protesters threw rocks at them and refused to disperse, and that officers also used non-chemical white smoke to minimize the amount of the irritant while maintaining a deterrent visual effect. She calls it a means to safely diffuse a volatile and dangerous situation. But tear gas is not safe, according to a number of experts interviewed by ProPublica. It has been found to cause long-term health consequences and can hurt those who aren't the intended targets, including people inside their homes. This would be enough of a problem in normal times, but now experts say the widespread, sometimes indiscriminate use of tear gas on American civilians in the midst of a respiratory pandemic threatens to worsen the coronavirus, along with racial disparities in its spread and who dies from it. As an immunologist, it scares me, says Dr. Purvi Parikh, an allergy and immunology doctor at NYU Long Gone Health. We just got through a brutal 2 months, and I'm really scared that we'll bring a second wave of COVID-19 sooner. It puts black communities in an impossible situation, says Dr. Joseph Nwadiko, an internist and a researcher at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. 13 of the 15 coronavirus patients in the intensive care unit where he works are black, he said. I worry that one of the compounding effects of structural racism is you'll see a second wave of black patients, including those who are out there defending their lives. In an open letter signed by 1,300 medical and public health professionals urging the police to stop using tear gas, smoke, and other respiratory irritants which could increase risk of COVID-19 by making the respiratory tract more susceptible to infection, exacerbating existing inflammation, inducing coughing. Here's what you need to know about tear gas and how it's being used by law enforcement in recent days. Tear gas can cause long-term harm by making people more susceptible to contracting influenza, pneumonia, and other illnesses. Tear gas is the generic term for a class of compounds that cause a burning sensation. Most law enforcement agencies in the U.S., including the Philadelphia Police Department this week, use a chemical called CS, short for 2-chloro-benzylmalonitrile. CS activates a specific pain receptor, one that's also triggered by eating wasabi, said Sven Erik Jort, professor of anesthesiology at Duke University. But CS is much more powerful, up to 100,000 times stronger than the sting from wasabi, he said. They are really pain nerve gases. They are designed to induce pain. CS is particularly painful when it gets on your skin or in your eyes. Doctors have advised protesters not to wear contact lenses. When inhaled, the pain induces people to cough. The compound degrades the mucous membranes in your eyes, nose, mouth, and lungs, the layers of cells that help protect people from viruses and bacteria. Scientists know little about how CS affects the general public. The most comprehensive studies were conducted by the U.S. military on thousands of recruits who were exposed to tear gas during training exercises. Afterward, it left them at higher risk for contracting influenza, pneumonia, bronchitis, and other respiratory illnesses. The soldiers were generally healthier than the average person, with fewer underlying conditions like asthma or heart disease. Studies of civilians in Turkey found that people who are repeatedly exposed to tear gas are more likely to have chronic bronchitis or chest pains and coughing that can last for weeks. It may also be linked to miscarriages. The effects worsen as people are repeatedly exposed to higher doses, but it's hard to measure the concentrations of tear gas during chaotic protests, and many who are affected will be reluctant or afraid to seek medical help. Parikh, the Langone health doctor, is particularly worried about children at the protests. Their lungs and immune system are still developing, and tear gas could lead to neurological problems or permanent skin or eye damage if it's not washed off quickly. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, severe tear gas poisoning, particularly if the gas was released in an enclosed space, can blind or kill people through chemical burns and respiratory failure. Prisoners with respiratory conditions have died after inhaling tear gas in poorly ventilated areas. An inmate at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn died after guards sprayed him with pepper spray, another kind of tear gas that causes similar health effects as CS. In a statement, the U.S. Department of Justice's Bureau of Prisons said the inmate, Jamel Floyd, was caught breaking the cell door window with a metal object and became increasingly disruptive and potentially harmful to himself and others. Medical staff immediately responded to assess the inmate, found Mr. Floyd to be unresponsive, and instantly initiated life-saving measures. An investigation is underway. tear gas can increase the spread of the coronavirus and might make some people more vulnerable to catching it. It's too early to know exactly how tear gas affects coronavirus patients, but Parikh said that both cause lung inflammation. Anything that's an irritant can cause that same inflammatory response, she said. Your lungs can fill with mucus and it can be very difficult to breathe. The muscles narrow. It's almost like breathing through a straw. People with asthma and other respiratory illnesses already have higher baseline inflammation that can make them more susceptible to catching infections like the flu or the common cold. So tear gas could trigger an asthma attack or weaken the body's ability to stave off COVID-19. If your lungs are already wheezing and coughing, working hard to expel this tear gas or this irritant is unable to have the reserve to fight off any infection, whether a virus or a bacteria. Talia Smith, a graduate student at the University of Nebraska, said it only took a whiff of tear gas to trigger an asthma attack when she was protesting in Omaha last Friday. She could barely feel it in her eyes, but her throat just immediately started closing, she said. Smith had brought her inhaler, but the medication inside was running low. She only had one asthma attack in her life before this. Smith had a burning feeling in her chest for days afterwards, and she went to get tested for the coronavirus. The results are pending. She worries that if she catches the virus while still feels the effects of the gas, she'd be fighting off the disease while her lungs aren't at full capacity. Parikh said there's not enough data on asthma and the coronavirus in general. While asthmatics are at higher risk for all respiratory infections, asthma isn't among the top chronic conditions for the most severe coronavirus patients. We are still seeing many asthmatics get it, so it's too soon to say there's no risk at all, she said. Tear gas weakens a demonstrator's protections against the coronavirus, said Dr. Abrar Khurana, a physician at Harvard Medical School, who's working on the coronavirus response. Infections increase when people cough or talk loudly, he said. And even if someone is wearing a mask, when you're hit with tear gas, they'll take off the mask as they're coughing. Not only are you vigorously coughing, you're vigorously inhaling or try to get more air in. Panic can cause a stampede, forcing people into close proximity as they're expelling large droplets from their mouths, he said, perfectly describing the situation that Chowbury experienced on Monday. Karan said he's worried that protests could turn into super-spreading events, yet he also understands why people feel they must be there. At the same time, I'm worried about my patients who've been destroyed by systemic racism, so racism killing them as much as a pandemic is. It will take at least another week before researchers can study whether protests led to outbreaks. Even then, it will be hard to tell whether the infections were caused solely by the large gatherings or whether tear gas contributed to the increase. Protesters aren't the only people at risk. Tear gas is entering homes and businesses. Jort has said he was surprised by the sheer quantity of tear gas used by police in recent days, based on what he's seen in online videos and news clips. Instead of reserving it for the most extreme situations, it's more like fumigating and flushing people out, he said. Tear gas has become a first-line response, not a last resort. Because many protests are occurring in residential neighborhoods, tear gas is now seeping into homes. Parikh compared it to secondhand smoke. It's a terrible situation, she said. To be honest, there's not much you can do. Chowbury, the UPenn student who participated in the Philadelphia protests, said she couldn't keep out the gas even when she stuffed t-shirts and towels under the doors and windows. She could still smell it the next morning. If the gas gets indoors, people should wipe down their countertops and other surfaces with large amounts of water and soap. Any food that wasn't in closed containers could be contaminated and should be thrown out. In extreme cases with large amounts of tear gas, residents and business owners may need to contact fire departments for recommendations of professional cleaning services, he added. Companies like Aftermath offer services for biohazard and infection control. Its website section on tear gas removal says the chemical leaves behind residue that can present serious health hazards if not properly treated. Tear gas residue can seep into porous materials like furniture, mattresses, clothing, carpet, and even hardwood floors, and continue to irritate the mucous membranes of anyone residing in or visiting the property long after the incident. Police tactics and tools can make matters worse. There are many different forms of tear gas and many ways to use it, said Anna Feigenbaum, the author of a recent book on the history of tear gas and an associate professor of communication and digital media at Bournemouth University in England. Police can spray it from cans, shoot canisters, or throw grenades. Manufacturers sell grenades that produce light and noise as they expel tear gas, and triple chaser canisters that break into multiple pieces when they land so the gas can cover larger areas. The technology to deploy tear gas is advancing far more quickly than scientists' understanding of the impact, George said. While use of these compounds is escalating, there is a vacuum of research to back up the safety of high-level use. Feigenbaum said the Current situation is dangerous because law enforcement has used tear gas at close range in enclosed spaces in large quantities fired directly at people. Use it offensively as a weapon in conjunction with rubber-coated bullets as a force multiplier. Last weekend, a college student in Indiana lost his eye when a tear gas canister hit his face. Tear gas is banned in international warfare. I'm going to say that again. Tear gas is banned in international warfare, but it is classified as a riot control agent that law enforcement can use for crowd control. Yet instead of calming the situation, tear gas can sometimes cause counter-aggression. It just doesn't work well, and it hits the weakest people the most and causes the most complications in them. One of the most controversial events occurred on Monday when law enforcement in Washington, D.C. used tear gas on peaceful demonstrators to clear the way so President Donald Trump could walk to a nearby church for a photo op. A statement from the U.S. Park Police said they used pepper balls with an unspecified irritant powder and smoke canisters. A reporter with WUSA 9 tweeted photos on Thursday of CS containers that he and his team said they found at the site. The CDC uses tear gas as a catch-all for any of the many riot control compounds with similar effects. Monica Sanders, who lives across the river in Alexandria, Virginia, said she could see the smoke from her house like something from a dystopian reality. A University of Delaware professor who specializes in disaster management, Sanders said she thought about attending that protest but decided against it because her lungs were still weak from an early infection that might have been coronavirus. Although she never got tested, Sanders said she came down with a respiratory illness in mid-February that almost sent her to the emergency room. She is a triathlete with no history of asthma. Last October, she swam a 5K race. Today, she can't even swim a mile. She said there are other ways to do crowd control that don't involve creating respiratory ailments during a pandemic in a city that doesn't have enough medical supplies. Okay, I'm going to have to end the show there due to time constraints, but I have some more shows, more stories that I'll cover on next week's show. And also some local news that I can wait till next week, but a question that was unanswered from last week. So if you have any questions or comments you'd like to send to me, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.